This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Our conservative think tanks running America. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, the daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The John M. Olin Foundation is shutting its doors today after 35 years of financial support for conservative ideas and institutions. In its wake, groups like the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute are defining policy for the Bush administration and the Congress. On To the Point, how did conservative think tanks get to be so powerful? Have they polarized the country? Can wealthy progressives adopt similar strategies and compete more effectively in the war of ideas? On Reporter's Notebook later on, another look at Tom DeLay's reapportionment of congressional districts in Texas. First up, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. As the John M. Olin Foundation shuts its doors today, what was its role in helping Republicans take over American government? How did conservative think tanks become so powerful? Can liberals adopt the same strategies to compete in the war of ideas? On Reporter's Notebook, Tom DeLay, congressional districts in Texas, and the Federal Voting Rights Act. First, this news update. The U.S. has carried out the 1,000th execution since capital punishment was reinstated in 1976. Kenneth Boyd was put to death this morning in North Carolina for killing his estranged wife and her father in 1988. Boyd never denied his guilt, and Governor Mike Easley found no compelling reason to grant clemency. The local sheriff said justice has been served. The execution comes at a time when death sentences are on the decline, and there's been some reduction in support for capital punishment. Frank Newport is executive director of the Gallup poll. Mr. Newport, always good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Warren.
You last polled on this subject in October, very recently. What'd you find?
64% of Americans favor the death penalty in cases of murder. That's our classic way of asking that question we've been asking since 1936. Even when you juxtapose it a little earlier this year, we did this with life imprisonment or no chance of parole. Some people say that's how we should ask it. You still have by 56 to 39% of margin Americans saying yes to the death penalty. I think this idea, Washington Post had an article today saying, oh, support for the death penalty dropping is exaggerated. It is down some. We did reach a peak in 1994 at 80%, so clearly it's down from that. But in recent years, it's been hovering right at the 64%, two-thirds level, and it's still, by all of our indications, a significant majority of Americans who say yes to the death penalty.
People opposed to capital punishment often say it all depends on how you ask the question, and you mentioned yourself that when you say there could be an alternative, namely life in prison without a possibility of parole, it drops, as I understand it, from 64 to 56. Isn't that fairly significant?
Well, yes, that is a drop, but the ratio with those wordings is still 56% death penalty, 39% life imprisonment with no chance of parole, and 5% no opinion. So it's still a substantial majority who favor the death penalty, even when you give that explicit alternative.
You have been polling on this subject at the Gallup poll since 1936, as
That's
you
right.
just indicated. What seems to be the most important factor in causing support or lack of support to fall or rise?
Well, the biggest factor, if you look at the long-term trend, was reality. There was a period of time when there were no death penalties in the 60s and so forth until the Supreme Court allowed it to be reinstituted, followed by the execution of Gary Gilmore. And when that happened in the 60s, support dropped all the way down to just 42% at one point in 1966. And again, that was at a point when there were no executions. So it's kind of positive news, I believe, for opponents of the death penalty. It does suggest that if for some reason the Supreme Court, and this is not likely, but if the Supreme Court outlawed the death penalty, it wouldn't be surprising to find public opinion after a while kind of coming along behind and saying, all right, I guess we are opposed to it.
There have been recent incidences involving DNA evidence that showed that people were on death row who had not, in fact, committed the murders that they were convicted of. It's often said, no nobody has ever been executed who didn't actually commit a murder. But when those kinds of revelations occur, is there then a change in support for capital punishment?
Well, I'd like to answer that in a couple of ways. It's a good point. First of all, I do believe that one of the reasons we may have had somewhat of a drop since the high point in 1994 of 80% is because of the increasing discussion of DNA evidence showing that people are on death row and or have been executed who may have been innocent. But at the same time, in the same poll where people show majority support for the death penalty, we have a majority who say they recognize occasionally somebody who's innocent will be killed. In May of this year, we found 59% of Americans said that over the last 5 years, at least one person has been executed under the death penalty who was in fact innocent. Now, that's important because it suggests to us that the public's actually willing to live with the margin of error. In other words, the public saying yes to the death penalty, even recognizing that occasionally an innocent person will be executed.
In Saudi Arabia today, there was a beheading. In Singapore, an Australian man was executed for the possession of a relatively small amount of heroin. There were protests around the world over those incidents and protests around the world over the execution in North Carolina as well. Do you think those have any make any impression on public opinion?
Well, it's hard to answer explicitly, or with data, I should say, empirically or scientifically, a question of what might change these attitudes. I just don't have any way of quantifying whether or not massive protests change people's attitudes. The one thing we do know, Warren, and I think this is important, is that people have a little more of an irrational rationale for the death penalty. They may recognize it's not a deterrent. They may recognize that an innocent person is occasionally executed, but they do believe, kind of biblically speaking, that it is psychologically satisfying to society. There is closure, an eye for an eye, as they said in the Bible, that someone is executed who committed a murder. And so when we've asked people over the years who supported why, that's the number one reason we get back, that it's justice is done.
Once again, the 1,000th execution since capital punishment was reinstated in 1976 has taken place today in North Carolina. The local sheriff there said justice is done. Frank Newport, executive editor of the Gallup Poll, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
In a moment, our conservative think tanks running America on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Norman, I'll be back with To the Point. Even liberals agree that a network of conservative philanthropies has been extraordinarily successful in changing American society in the past 35 years. One of those is the foundation started by John M. Olin, a businessman who made his fortune in chemicals and munitions. Today, the Olin Foundation is closing its doors, just as Olin himself hoped that it would. The final executive director is James Pearson, who joins us now. Mr. Pearson, thanks very much for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Before we get to the great reasons for closing down, tell us what the foundation was designed to do and what you think it's accomplished.
Well, John Olin started the foundation in a serious way in the mid-1970s. That was a low point for American conservatism. We had just lost a war in Vietnam. Richard Nixon had been forced out of office. Democrats were more or less in control of all the major institutions. John Olin saw things going the wrong direction. He was a trustee at a couple of universities, including Cornell. He was concerned what he saw there. He said in the mid-1970s that he wanted to dedicate his foundation to recovering the fundamentals of American life. That meant liberty, respect for the Constitution, respect for private enterprise, and a belief in progress in the future based on those institutions. And that is more or less what our foundation set out to do. And we worked in the world of ideas. We worked with magazines, intellectuals, university programs where we could find good ones, public television programs. We worked across the board trying to promote these fundamental ideas in American life.
So when you're talking about institutions in the United States, you're talking about much more than just government.
Oh, yes, indeed. We're talking about what we call the leveraging institutions in our society. That would be the universities, the major journalistic institutions, the major think tanks, important publications. Yes, that means much more than the government, because these institutions influence the government.
So what do you think the foundation itself, then, has achieved?
I would say that from the late 1970s down to the present, we began to wind back a few years ago. What we did, I believe, was we helped to build an infrastructure of conservative institutions, magazines, think tanks, university programs, books, publishing ventures, which on a continuing basis articulate conservative ideas about limited government, the importance of religion in our society, the importance of free enterprise, a respect for free markets, and, of course, a respect for our heritage of limited government, going back to the Constitution and the Founding Fathers.
No one would disagree that the Olin Foundation has been successful in the way that you have just described. Why is it shutting down?
This was John Olin's wish. John Olin was very much influenced by a situation at the Ford Foundation that arose in the late 1970s when Henry Ford II resigned from the foundation because he found that foundation had little respect for the institutions of capitalism, which had created the wealth for the foundation. He said he tried to work from the inside, had little success, and therefore resigned, somewhat in protest. John Olin did not want that to happen to his foundation, so he appointed a board of trustees a generation younger than he. He was in his 80s. These trustees were in their 50s, and he told them to spend the money out during their working lifetimes.
Was he worried then that the force of conservatism would die out, that it wouldn't be able to sustain itself after a certain period of time?
Well, he certainly was concerned about that, but he was more concerned that his foundation, endowed by his money, would somehow be captured by people who did not share his views and objectives.
What about the world as we see it today, and particularly the war in Iraq? To what extent do you think the kinds of ideas, the kinds of principles and goals that the foundation was set up to establish are involved in what we see now?
Well, I think it is related. Many of the people who've made arguments in support of the war in Iraq are friends of ours and people we've supported, and we're very sympathetic to that. However, I said at a farewell dinner that we had recently that we are in a new era now. The preoccupations that were present in the late 1970s and 1980s that led to the formation of this foundation have more or less run their course. I'm thinking of the Cold War, socialism, heavy crime in the cities, and issues related to that. In my view, our foundation straddled an era that lasted 25 or 30 years from the mid-70s to, say, the turn of the century. And our efforts were focused on those problems. In a certain sense, we feel that our work is done. We're in a new era, and it's time for other philanthropists to step forward and carry on the battle in a new time.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
James Pearson, Executive Director of the John M. Olin Foundation. Until today, he will now be Executive Director for the William Simon Foundation. That's another conservative think tank. Some of the organizations to which the Olin Foundation contributed to during its 35 years of active involvement, the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Manhattan Institute, the Federalist Society, Hoover Institution, Project for a New American Century, one of the places where the ideology behind the war in Iraq was developed. We're going to talk more about the Olin Foundation in a moment, but first, let's take a broader, more general look at think tanks in Washington. Andrew Rich is author of a book entitled Think Tanks, Public Policy, and the Politics of Expertise, and he is a professor of political science at the City College of New York. Professor, good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What is a think tank?
A think tank's a public policy research organization, and the boundaries are pretty loose as to what might be considered a think tank, but the history of these organizations goes back actually about a century to when the social sciences were developing, and we basically said, all right, we've got new ways of doing research that could inform public problems, and so we want to create these research organizations that'll help government figure out what to do for people. And that was the original notion of a think tank. It sort of changed significantly over time to now be organizations frequently that are kind of marketers of ideas more than producers of research. And so beginning in the 1970s, you saw the formation of the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, and a number of these conservative institutions that you just discussed that really changed what we think of as a think tank in many respects, or at least broadened it.
What was the role of the Olin Foundation?
Olin was significant. There's a kind of small group of conservative foundations that have been instrumental in providing support to conservative think tanks and other kinds of conservative organizations, just the way that Jim Pearson described it. And also, though, important has been a bigger group of individual donors, rich, wealthy conservative people who have been tapped by these new organizations to provide sustaining support. And so the foundations and individuals together actually, I think, help understand how we've gotten so many new and large conservative organizations.
James Pearson talked about the infrastructure of conservative institutions. So are they then all more or less related?
They're not related. I mean, conservatives don't all agree about everything, and there are different kinds of there are different perspectives you can have within what we would call conservative, being conservative in this country, and that's reflected in the think tanks, policy organizations. So there's sort of many different ways they can play themselves out. And then they're different in terms of what they actually do. You know, some of them are more research-oriented. Others are focused primarily on marketing and promoting ideas. So there is variation, and there's no sort of single network among them. But they are all on the same page with respect to viewing themselves as part of a kind of war of ideas, or understanding American politics as something where ideas matter. And I think that's what unites conservatives, and it's what unites conservative organizations, is that they see themselves as, in the end, falling behind efforts to promote ideas.
Talk with Andrew Rich at the City College of New York, author of Think Tanks, Public Policy and the Politics of Expertise. Mr. Pearson of the Olin Foundation talked earlier about what he referred to as leveraging institutions, and he mentioned universities, journalism, think tanks, publications of various kinds. When he said journalism, of course, all of us in journalism, including this program, often have on as guests people from these various think tanks, so that the impact that they've had on public debate is very clear. What about these other leveraging institutions?
Well, I think the way conservatives have viewed this, and I think conservatives haven't been the only groups that have, or only folks who have viewed it this way, is that you can have all the great ideas you want. If you don't have a way of promoting them or kind of finding an audience for them, then they're not going to inform public policy and change the terms of public discussion. And so I think what Olin understood was the importance of not just having the ideas, but marketing them effectively, finding ways to promote them, both reaching out to the American people and saying, look, we actually think you believe in some of this, but here's a way for you to think about organizing it in your minds, going to policymakers and going to journalists and saying, you know, you have sort of a broad concept of what it means to believe in limited government and free enterprise, but here's how that could play out in terms of specific policy proposals. And I think that in large part, that's how they thought about what they wanted to leverage. They wanted to bring the ideas and put them into concrete form for people to use.
You said that these conservative foundations, Olin and others, have sort of changed the idea and the function of think tanks, in part by adopting this marketing strategy that you mentioned. What about the liberal or progressive foundations? Why haven't they been able to keep up?
Well, there's a lot of reasons, I think. Some of them are kind of mechanical, having to do with how foundations work and how foundations that aren't conservative tend to be organized. Some of it, I think, though, does have to do with how they position the role of ideas in politics, that for non-conservatives, it's sort of hard to identify, frankly, what's a liberal, what's progressive, but at least for non-conservatives, those that aren't so clearly conservative, the function of think tanks, for example, has largely been one to produce research, policy research, and that research should inform the best practices of government. They haven't embraced ideas, and they certainly haven't embraced ideology in the same way. There's a certain pragmatism in how they think about the world of politics. And I think also liberals, and here again, there's lots of different brands of liberals, but liberals have often believe that there could be a consensus. So rather than thinking about American politics as polarized, and you've got conservatives and then you've got the rest of us fighting against the conservatives, they think that there's some way that they could find common ground where the American people exist. And so the idea of engaging in ideological wars or battles can seem unappealing at times.
Again, Andrew Rich is author of Think Tanks, Public Policy, and the Politics of Expertise, leads us neatly into our next guest, who is Simon Rosenberg, president and founder of the National Democratic Network, and now also founded the Democracy Alliance, which is a group of affluent Democrats that are committed to grant giving in this model, as I understand it, of what we've been hearing about the Conservative Foundation. Simon Rosenberg, thanks for joining us.
No problem, Warren. Thank you.
What do you say to what Andrew Rich just said, that on your side of the first of all, it's difficult to define what liberalism or progressivism is. Secondly, it's really not ideological. How then can you adopt the same kind of strategy that the conservatives have?
Well, I think a little bit of history here is important, and I think Andrew has done a phenomenal job at laying all this out. But I think one of the reasons we perhaps didn't have the same commitment to think tanks that the conservatives had is that, you know, the way, first of all, the 20th century was really dominated by the progressive approach and by Democrats in government, and we wielded power. And the way that our values and our ideas reached the American people was largely through the government of the United States for most of the 20th century. So when the conservatives set out, as James Pearson said in his piece, to sort of take on this machine on the progressive side in the 70s, they were a beleaguered minority in the life of the United States, and we were the ones who held power. Our ideas and our values dominated. And we also had very powerful sister institutions. We had the labor movement, which at one point reached more than half of the American people, and we had this urban, ethnic-based political machine around the Democratic Party that was able to keep our politics in power. And what happened is, what the conservatives understood, is by redefining politics, to add to traditional politics, you know, campaigns and elections, this vast C3 intellectual infrastructure, and also a whole part of politics, for-profit media, I mean, Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, the Internet, they built a very modern 21st century political machine. I call it an information age Tammany Hall. And they've used this to seize power today to the point where Republicans have more power in the United States than any time since the 1920s. And so, in essence, we didn't need to build this alternative infrastructure because, as James Pearson said, we controlled the major institutions in the United States. Today, with conservatives and Republicans having all this power, we are now at the point they were previously, where we've now got to build up our own capacity to take our values and our ideas to the American people, since we don't have the same vehicles that we had for most of the 20th century.
All right. Hold that thought, because we're going to take a very brief break, and then we'll come back and continue this conversation, find out what it is that progressives can do, if they can, in fact, adopt similar strategies to those used by conservatives so effectively by the Olin Foundation and others. A little later on Reporter's Notebook, another look at Tom DeLay's reapportionment of congressional districts in Texas. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, once again talking about think tanks and foundations so successfully deployed by conservatives in the United States in the late years of the 20th century and certainly the early years of the 21st century. Talking now with Simon Rosenberg, president and founder of the New Democratic Network, also a founder of the Democracy Alliance, which is an effort to respond, I guess is the best way to put it, to what the conservatives have been doing. Mr. Rosenberg, again, thanks for being with us. with us. What now is the job if you are now out of power, perhaps not in the same kind of minority as Republicans were in the 1970s, but certainly out of power? What do you do now?
Well, we have a lot of building to do. I mean, first of all, we do have to really reimagine, what the core mission of a progressive or liberal, as Andrew was saying. And, you know, I think the difference between conservatives and progressives is that we believe in activist but limited government. I think we have to, we have to build our elements of a 21st century network and machine to take our values and our ideas to the American people. So I think the elements that we're going to have to copy or be inspired by is building out our intellectual infrastructure to sort of match what's been built on their side, to use, as he pointed, these leverage points, the modern media, much more effectively. Some of the analysis we've done is that, the conservative movement can probably reach 35 to 40 million people every week through their various means to take their ideas and their values to the American people. We can probably reach 10 to 15 million people a week on the progressive side. We've got to invest in things like Air America and the blogosphere and other ways of building our media up to take, our argument to the American people. And I think part of the reason this has been difficult is, I think Andrew's right, is that progressives have always wanted, in part because we were the governing party, that we wanted to believe that compromise and that government was a could work together with both and bring both sides together to find the best solution to a problem. And I think it's taken us a while to understand that we've got to actually really build this alternative structure to communicate our ideas and our values to the American people. So I think we're being inspired by what the Olin Foundation did, not necessarily replicating it or copying it, because it will be done very much, meeting these new challenges of the 21st century. I think one thing that Pearson said that was fascinating was this notion that they sort of tackled a bunch of problems and now there are some new struggles that are going to be out there for the conservative movement to tackle. I certainly think that's very true.
But if progressivism is difficult to define, if it's based in part on compromise and consensus, if it's pragmatic about problems rather than ideological, isn't that quite the opposite of what's happened with the Conservative Foundation? And hasn't the genius of it been to work over the years to develop a very coherent a philosophical base from which to derive policy? Isn't it sort of by definition difficult for progressives to do that?
I don't think so, because I think that obviously the government, their conservative government today, where they now have unfettered power, so we're learning what they would do if unchecked. I think obviously what progressives would have done faced with the same set of circumstances in the last few years would have been very different. And I think that just to sum up, where I think we are, and I think is it's very important to recognize that when we were last in power under Bill Clinton, the country got better. People had more wealth. We were at peace around the world. Social programs were reformed. We left our 8 years in office. We left America stronger and better. The conservatives can't say that. And I think what's so interesting about Pearson sort of saying we did good and now there are new challenges is that the conservative movement, I think its great accomplishment so far has been as a critique of liberalism as opposed to creating a viable alternative to it, and as evidenced by the utter failure of modern conservative government in the United States today. George Bush, in his time that he's been here, in the 5 years he's been in office, the American people are poorer, we are less safe than we were when he entered office, and we're seeing a conservative movement now, unchecked, has become as corrupt as any group of people in American history. And so I think what makes me feel optimistic about our role and our aspiration on the progressive side is that when we were there, right, we created broad-based prosperity. We left the world at peace. We honored faith, family, and community. The core values of modern progressivism, which I think are simple, limited but activist government as opposed to just limited government, worked very well. So I think unlike the conservatives who, when they lost their power in the 30s and 40s and 50s, who had created the Great Depression and appeased Hitler, right? I mean, our last time that we had power, we did good. And so I think that we do need to build this alternative infrastructure, largely because our competition has invested billions of dollars over 40 years in building a much more modern machinery to take their values and their ideas to the American people. I think progressives have to do the same thing, because, and I think that we believe that our values are superior.
All right.
and therefore we're more morally obligated to be better at communicating them to the American people.
Simon Rosenberg with the New Democratic Network, one of the founders of the Democracy Alliance, a group of affluent Democrats committed to grant giving to progressive organizations comparable to that that we have seen on the Republican and conservative side. John Miller is a writer for the National Review magazine, conservative magazine, of course. He's also author of A Gift of Freedom, How the John M. Olin Foundation Changed America. John Miller, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me on.
You're part of this infrastructure of leveraging institutions that we heard about a moment ago that can reach 35 or 40 million people. What do you say to what we just heard from Simon Rosenberg? Do you think that progressives can do the same thing that Olin and the other foundations have done on the right?
Well, you're asking a couple questions there. And,
and
being a writer for National Review, I'm sort of astonished to learn how powerful I am compared to the compared to all the liberals in the mainstream media and at the universities, and how they just can't reach anybody, and how we somehow are all powerful because, you know, Rush Limbaugh's on the radio and you know, some people watch Fox News. I mean, this notion that liberals are completely outgunned by conservatives in the media and in the marketing of ideas, I think is not quite accurate. But as to your other question, can liberals do what conservatives have done and create a network similar to the ones conservatives have? Well, they have to. You know, you have to begin by realizing that they already have a lot of powerful institutions on their side, like the mainstream media, like 90% of the university professors in this country. When John M. Olin turned his foundation towards conservative causes, he and the leadership of the foundation very consciously set out to create what they called a counterintelligentsia. And by that, they meant a group of scholars and intellectuals who would oppose the intelligentsia, who were entirely liberal. And that intelligentsia still exists today. It has been effectively countered, and this counterintelligentsia now at think tanks and various other places does have influence. But they actually start out with an awful lot of institutions on their side, and there are some things they obviously can do to try and, you know, lessons they can learn from the experience of the John M. Olin Foundation, and some of them are just simply mechanical things like. You should keep the size of your board small, and you should have a very clearly defined goal, things of that nature. But ultimately, a lot of this is going to come down to the power of ideas. It's not all about clever marketing and who has more money. We all know it's not about who has more money, because the Ford Foundation has more money than all the major conservative philanthropies combined. But it does come down to the power of ideas themselves. And that's ultimately what liberals will need to come up with, are some very smart solutions to the problems facing the United States today.
Are you concerned that with the kind of effort that's being put out by Simon Rosenberg and others, that there's going to be more competition in the world of ideas very soon than there has been in the recent past?
Well, conservatives, I don't think, fear competition at all. We embrace it. And in fact, one of the reasons why the conservative philanthropists got involved in the war of ideas is because there simply was no competition a generation ago. The conservative movement was really, you know, 30 years ago was almost nothing. I mean, we think back to, you know, how Barry Goldwater was crushed in 1964, and the conservative movement is really, although it's probably the most important political movement in the United States since the end of the Second World War, it's also really one of the newest movements in American political history. So it is very, very young.
What do you say about Simon Rosenberg's contention that having taken over the government, the conservatives have failed? The nation is poorer, less safe, more corrupt, or certainly as corrupt on Capitol Hill as it was than it was 8 years ago.
Well, I found his comments extremely partisan, for one thing. I think we have to.
Well, what's wrong with that? Aren't the
there's nothing wrong with that. But let's recognize it. And first of all, conservatives don't control government. Republicans control many of the branches of government, but that is different from saying conservatives control government. And this notion that that we're somehow living in a conservative political age, I think is wrong. If you just look at the size of government, how it is expanding massively, and this is happening under Republican-controlled government. This is not a conservative vision of government by any means, with the explosive spending growth we're seeing in Washington. And this is not all defense and homeland security spending. This is discretionary spending, entitlements, and so forth. And a lot of this is driven by liberalism that is very entrenched in Washington culture, this runaway spending is. So I don't accept the notion that we live in a time of conservatives controlling the levers of power in this country, although I will admit that conservatives have a lot more authority than they've had in the past. And secondarily, this sort of notion that you know, the Clinton years were somehow utopian and we're so much better than today. I mean, the economy is growing quite well right now. You know, Simon said that we're all a lot safer in the 1990s. Well, we weren't at war, and of course, we weren't really planning for terrorism. Perhaps all of us became a lot less safe on 9/11. I wish some of the people who had been doing such a wonderful job of running the country in the 1990s perhaps had been paying a little bit more attention to this problem.
Okay, a lot of issues obviously involved here, and when you say partisanship, our principal focus here is on the foundations as opposed to the outcomes that I guess we're now talking about. I want to get back to the foundations and go back to Andrew Rich, again, author of Think Tank's Public Policy and the Politics of Expertise. When we talk about the differences between the conservatives and the liberals in this context, you made a point that the conservative foundations have been based more on ideology, whereas in the past, at least, the progressive ones have been based on research for its own sake. What's the difference there?
Well, both research and what's sort of caught up in the notion of doing research, which is we want to be problem solvers. And so, you know, rather than approaching the world with a set of ideas and trying to figure out, well, how do those ideas apply in a whole bunch of different contexts? How could we kind of play them out into policy? How could we play them out into changes in our society in the best ways to reflect those ideas? A focus that begins with the value of research and the notion of a kind of problem-based approach says, all right, what's this problem? You know, let's look at the environment. And what does research done in a very kind of rigorous way tell us about the best way to address this environmental problem? And then let's move over to the issue of poverty, and then let's move to the issue of civil rights. And it lacks a sort of overarching philosophy or set of values that might guide it. Operating in that context has a lot of merit, but it doesn't necessarily kind of contribute to a war of ideas very effectively.
Again, Simon Rosenberg is with the New Democratic Network and one of the people who's helped found the Democratic Alliance. I describe that as a group of affluent Democrats. He's not one of the affluent Democrats. He is, in fact, an operative that is helping to put all of this in motion. And Simon Rosenberg, let me come back to you. You said that the big success of the conservative foundations was to develop a critique of liberalism, but that they'd failed to provide a viable alternative. And you used as an example of that what you felt were the failures of the Republican administration. Are you admitting that there's going to have to be more polarization ideologically on the part of progressives and liberals in order to achieve the same kind of success as the conservatives have?
It's a great question, Warren, and I just want to first pick up on something Andrew said, is that I think that part of the reason why I think progressive institutions were so research-based was because they were adjuncts to the governing party, and we had power, and therefore what we were involved in was actually solving problems because we already had the levers of power. And so we needed more technical expertise and help as opposed to ideological expertise and help. And I think that's one of the reasons why many of the progressive think tanks were more technical than ideological. And I think you're starting to see that change now in this era after we have lost the Congress, which we held for most of 60 years. But I think, Warren, the answer to your question about whether it has to become more polarized, I don't know if that's exactly the right way to look at it. I think what we've learned is that we have to get more serious about making our broader case about what we're for, what our values are, what our ideas are, because in some ways we were like the third generation family business, the kids, the third generation of a family business that didn't even know why the business was created in the first place. We've been in power for so long, And I think for many Democrats and progressives, the assumption was that we were going to be in power forever. And so we were focused more on governing and problem solving than making a large argument, because as you know, as was said earlier, most of the levers of power, most of the American people were fundamentally in agreement with us. That's changed. The conservative movement has fundamentally created much greater competition in the war of ideas. I agree with everything was said by Mr. Miller. And I think we're now learning that we can't assume that people agree with us, and we've got to fight harder to take what we believe is a superior value system, and one that when we were in power did a lot of good, as opposed to what they've done when they were in power, and make that case to the American people. And I think that's what you're seeing on the investment side and the institution building that's now happening on our end. We've got to both have a clearer voice and a louder one, too, in the debate. And so I think we've learned our lessons from what the Olin Foundation has done and other foundations in building a modern progressive movement.
Again, Simon Rosenberg, pardon me, is with New Democratic Network and the Democracy Alliance. Again, we're talking about foundations like the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, the Manhattan Institute, the Federalist Society. We haven't talked much about that, a little different from the others. The Hoover Institution, the Project for a New American Century. John Miller, back to you with National Review. What are the important ideas that you think the conservative foundations have contributed to America that are now going to have to be, and I think I hear Simon Rosenberg trying to do this a bit, incorporated into any kind of progressive response?
Well, there are quite a few, and the John M. Olin Foundation has really been involved in just about every aspect of American political life. I mean, looking at problems and groups has been funding and so forth. I compare it to a NASCAR race. That if you look at the world of conservative scholars and intellectuals, and if they were race cars zipping around a track, just about every one of them would have a bumper sticker on them that says Olin, and quite a few would have the letters OLIN splashed on their hoods. What are some of their most meaningful accomplishments? Well, for example, law and economics, the notion that legal rules have economic consequences and the judges should pay attention to these. This is a fairly, you know, sort of a common sense idea, you would think, except it's actually a fairly new idea in the law in terms of its rigorous application and a kind of methodology. And the John M. Olin Foundation is actually spent more in this area than any other, and it's had quite an impact on law schools around the country, and ultimately in the judiciary in terms of thinking about how laws and court decisions affect the economy. Another thing it's had a big role in is welfare policy. For example, we had a big welfare reform in 1996 that has been extremely successful, and that is a conservative accomplishment because it is a reversal of liberal welfare statism.
Even though a Democratic president signed the bill,
he did sign a bill, and of course he did it because and the only reason it passed Congress is because Republicans made it past Congress, and he did it. He did it because Bill Clinton was in some ways more of a reform-minded Democrat than most of the members of his party. I mean, he did sign it. But this was made possible by a Republican Congress, and before that by conservatives who started proposing solutions to what everybody recognized, what everybody who was honest at least recognized, was the enormous welfare problem in this country. And the John M. Olin Foundation's role in all of this was helping support the scholar Charles Murray write his book Losing Ground, which came out in 1984. It's one of the most important books to have come out in the last 20 or 30 years, and it really just shifted the whole debate in our country.
I'm going to interrupt just because of the interest of time. I just want to get a response from Simon Rosenberg to this. Law and economics, one area, welfare, another. The Charles Murray book came out in 1984. It took 14 years before there was welfare reform. What kind of time frame are we talking about if the Democrats are going to get back into the competition for the war of ideas?
Well, I want to agree with something John said earlier, which is that I still believe that conservatism has been more of a political success than an ideological success, meaning that the Republicans, and it was interesting to listen to his distinction between Republicans and conservatives, because certainly there's a lot of people trying to distance themselves from the failures of the Bush administration these days.
Quickly, if you will, because we're out of time, and I want to know what the Democrats are doing or what your
really quickly
doing.
Is that I don't think we have as much work to do as they did. Their movement was an utter failure on foreign policy and domestic policy. We have not been. And I think at the end of the day, they have proven to be more of critiques of modern 20th century progressivism than really offering a wholesale alternative. So I think that the country is still very much open to even where the, you know, as the Democrats governed the country in the 90s, that form of the Democratic Party, pro-market, you know, concerned about faith, family, community, responsible foreign policy, is really where America is today. So I think we are I don't think we have as far a road to travel as they did to get to both be in the intellectual idea game and to seize power again.
John Miller, very quickly, 30 seconds left. What about the war in Iraq, and will its outcome have a lot to do with what happens ultimately in this whole battle of ideas?
Well, I think the war in Iraq obviously will have a lot of political consequences in the near term. In the long term, conservatives will still have a lot to say in foreign policy debates, and you know, both pro and con in Iraq, and you know, we'll and really the right thing to do with Iraq is to take the long view, not to think about what it's going to be like 1 year from now, but what will it be like 20 years from now.
Okay, we started out talking about think tanks, and we ended up talking about policies and political realities, which it seems to me illustrates just how important these think tanks are and how important they have been and will continue to be in American life. Thanks, all of you. John Miller with the National Review, Simon Rosenberg with the New Democratic Network, Andrew Rich at City College of New York, Think Tanks, Public Policy, and the Politics of Expertise, and our earlier guest, James Pearson, former director, as of today, of the John M. Olin Foundation. After Tom DeLay's reapportionment plan in Texas, Republicans won 5 new seats in the Congress. Now it turns out the Justice Department lawyers assigned to the case were unanimous in deciding that the plan violated federal law. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Norman Olney back with Purporter's Notebook on To the Point. The Federal Voting Rights Act of 1965 requires states with histories of discriminatory elections to submit changes in voting systems to the Department of Justice. Today's Washington Post reports on a 73-page staff memo by 6 lawyers and 2 analysts saying new congressional districts illegally diluted black and Hispanic voting power in the state of Texas. Dan Egan wrote the story. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here.
Once again, now this was a reapportionment engineered by Tom DeLay, the former majority leader. He got 5 new Republican seats out of it. What happened to this staff memo?
It was overruled. This was produced by a team that analyzed the Texas case for the voting section within the Justice Department. And as the process works, they then forward it to their superiors. But a week later, the Justice Department notified Texas that the redistricting could go ahead.
Is this a case where the staff people are career attorneys and they were overruled by political appointees?
Yes, at least for the most part. It's not clear whether so far the Justice Department has declined to say who was involved with approving the plan. But certainly all of these people who were involved in this memo are career employees.
What about the Attorney General himself, who is, of course, of Hispanic background and you would think might be concerned? He has said that voting rights was one of the things he was most concerned about.
Right. Well, this first of all, this did happen prior to him being Attorney General. This was when John Ashcroft was Attorney General in December of 2003. Mm-hmm. As it happens, the Attorney General, Gonzalez, did have a press meeting this morning, and he basically defended the decision in this case and in Georgia, which is a somewhat similar set of issues involving a voter identification plan in which a staff review team recommended rejecting, and the political appointees and some career people went the other way. And he just simply says that there is no politicization within the Justice Department, and the people disagree, and these were examples of that.
This, of course, has been challenged by Democrats. They've appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, so it still may be heard from on the Texas reapportionment. You have reported, Dan Egan of the Washington Post, that in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, there's been a lot of unhappiness on the part of career lawyers. A lot of them have left.
Right, right. There was last year was or fiscal 2005, I should say, which ended just a month or so ago, was something near 20% of the attorneys in that division left. Part of that was due to a buyout program, but even if you take that out, it was still a higher than normal rate of attrition. And in general, there's a lot of complaints from former and current lawyers about the atmosphere within that division and the very strained relations with the political appointees.
What does the Justice Department itself officially have to say about that?
Well, that a lot of the complaints are overblown. They correctly point out that if you look over the whole 5 years so far of the Bush administration and the number of lawyers who've left the Civil Rights Division, and you know, you even it out over that time period, the attrition rate is only a point or two higher than it was in the last 5 years of the Clinton administration, for example. And more broadly, they say they're just as aggressive in enforcing civil rights laws and that the complaints are misplaced.
All right. So for the moment, it's all in how you look at it. I guess with regard to the Texas case and perhaps one in Georgia as well, the courts still not have all been heard from. Is that right?
Correct. And it should be noted that the courts are not looking at the same issues that the Justice Department is required under statute to look at. Without getting too much into the legalese, the Justice Department looks at particularly at whether minority voters are worse
right.
off, whereas it's a broader and different set of things that the courts look at.
Dan Egan, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Staff writer for The Washington Post. Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Ileana Justice, Jonah King, Sherman Rimbaum, managing producer Cameron Radziner. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.